All right, well, good morning, church. Welcome to 2025. Yeah. The year of domestic terrorism. Thanks for the open borders. Got weird things happening left and right already within how many days? What are we on, the fifth day of January already? 2024 is going to end up looking like a cakewalk. By the time 2025 is over, right? I'll be honest with you, I cannot believe that they just gave Presidential Medal of Freedom to George Soros. It's like handing it to Satan directly. I don't get that one at all. I mean, Bono and Michael J. Fox and some of these people, you're like, okay, I understand, yeah, you know, I want to root for them. But George Soros and then Hillary Clinton, give me a break. Come on, that just tells you exactly what you need to know about the last 4 years right there. Anyway, all I have to say, this is my motto for 2025. It can be your motto too. It can be the church's motto if we want. This is my motto. It's wake up, armor up, look up. Right? That's my motto for 2025. That's like Ephesians 5, Ephesians 6, and Luke 21. So wake up, armor up, look up. You know, because the day is approaching. The day is approaching. Someone should put that on a bumper sticker. I'm just saying. All right, we're going to be in Daniel chapter 1. I'm excited to start Daniel. So excited I forgot to mark where it is in my Bible. But we're in Daniel chapter 1. And Daniel's a very exciting book to go through. And it ties in with a lot of other books. For example, Ezekiel and Jeremiah and even Lamentations and Ezra. It's a book of great historical value as well as prophetic, obviously, value. It's a book that you need to know a few things before we get started. Have anybody here ever gone through the book of Daniel? Okay. They divide the prophetic books in the Old Testament this way. So they divide them between the major prophets and the minor prophets. The minor prophets, there's 12 minor prophet books. I'm going to take my glasses off. There are 12 minor prophet books. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. All right? So those are your 12 minor prophet books. There are 5 major prophet books. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, and Daniel. Right. So do you consider Daniel a prophet? Would be a good question to ask. Some people do not consider Daniel to be a prophet, even though his book is considered a major prophetic book. Some people think that's a strange question. The reason I bring it up is, as I said, some people don't consider him to be a prophet, even though his book is a major prophetic book in the Old Testament. That being said, Daniel was name-dropped in Ezekiel, and of course Jesus refers to Daniel as well in Matthew 24. And when Jesus refers to Daniel in Matthew 24, he says, "So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand." So Daniel, is Daniel a prophet? Yes. Jesus referred to him as a prophet. He's a prophet. However, some people just more or less kind of look at him the same way you might look at Joseph, for example, because they have a lot of similarities. The ability to discern dreams and such. Was Joseph considered a prophet? No. When you look at the visions that Daniel gets towards the end of the book, specifically chapters 10 to 12, and the apocalyptic visions he gets and how they line up with the book of Revelations and etc. Is John considered a prophet for having those similar visions himself when he gets the revelation? No. But Daniel is a prophet. And he is a prophet that he and Jeremiah, for example, are prophets at like the same time. They had different jobs. Daniel gets taken into captivity. Jeremiah is not taken into captivity, but yet he's ministering to those who are captive and bringing message to them before they were taken into captivity, etc. That's Daniel, who reads the book of Jeremiah, which we'll get to when we go through it. So Daniel is a very interesting book, to say the least. It's a book of historical value, like I said. It's a prophetic value. It has something for everyone. It's a perfect book to start the new year with. I think it's incredibly applicable for us to be reading this now. There's a lot that we're going to be able to learn for this and apply from this for this New Year's. But like I said, before we start, there are some things you need to know. The first thing you should understand, and I don't think this is a problem for anyone here, but I'm going to mention it anyway, is the very first verse in the Bible, which says, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth." Why is that important to the book of Daniel? Well, it's not specifically important to the book of Daniel, but it is important in the sense that if you have a problem with that very first verse in the book of Genesis, you're going to have a problem with the rest of the Bible. Because that very first verse in the book of Genesis explains to you who God is. God's a creator. God created everything. God created the heavens and the earth. God created mankind. God is above it all. And as it tells us in Colossians 1:16, "For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him." Right? And this has to do with Daniel, because if God is the creator of all things, the architect of the universe, then he is sovereign, obviously, over all things as well. And if God is sovereign, which he is, then as Benjamin Franklin put it, God governs in the affairs of men. God is the judge of all the earth, as it says in Genesis 18, or as Nebuchadnezzar will come to learn the hard way later in this book, God is sovereign over the kingdom of men, and he gives it to him as he will, right? So basically what he is saying is God has everything to do with how the nations operate and how the kings rule and what they do against all the other nations and how they act and how they come against them or how they don't come against them and how God uses them to bring judgment or to not bring judgment or to do whatever he wants to do. It all has to do with God. It all has to do with God's sovereignty, and that's something you have to be aware of as we go through the book of Daniel, because the judgment that's been brought upon Israel, that's brought them into captivity, is because of God's sovereign judgment. And the same judgment that will be brought upon Babylon, for example, and Nebuchadnezzar, is also part of God's sovereign judgment. It's all part of God's sovereign judgment. He governs in the affairs of men. And if you don't think that God governs in the affairs of men, you're going to have a hard time with Daniel. Right? Now, there's something else to be aware of as well as we go through the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel has 12 chapters. And it's written in Aramaic, and it's also written in Hebrew. They call the Aramaic, actually he refers to it, Daniel refers to it as the language of the Chaldeans, because it was the language of the Chaldeans. We'll get more into that as we go through the book, because it's important for us to know who the Chaldeans were as well, as we go through it, and it covers roughly 80 years of history from the beginning. Now, the times and dates that I'm going to give you, and I'm working on a timeline, but let me tell you, it's a lot of work. I have just as many pages of notes as I do, just that I'm using for reference as I go through and study, as I do for my message. So I've written two completely different documents this week. One was just pages of notes and references and stuff that I'm referencing as I go, and I can write the message for Daniel, because there's so much information. So the times and dates that we're talking about as we go through Daniel, I wrote right here, 607 BC. 607 BC, and some might say 605 BC. This is roughly when the Daniel starts in chapter 1, okay? And it covers roughly 80 years of history. And it goes beyond, you know, Daniel's in, well, I should say Israel technically is in captivity for 70 years, but Daniel's there longer, okay? So the first six chapters of the book of Daniel are historical. They're historical. And the last six chapters concern the prophetic visions, specifically the last three chapters, right? Verses 10 through 12. They're a glimpse into the end of days, much the same as John saw in Revelation. So one could say, without too much hyperbole, that there are things that Daniel saw that were not seen again until John saw them in the book of Revelation. Or, and I don't think this is a stretch, there were things that were sealed up with Daniel that were not opened until Revelation. right? Daniel is told to shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. He's told this in Daniel chapter 12. In Revelation chapter 5, Jesus opens the book because he's the only one worthy to do so. And then John is ordered not to seal up what he saw because the time is near. In Revelation chapter 22, it's all related. Okay? So the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation are cousins prophetically. You could say they're siblings if you want to, if that's a better analogy. It doesn't matter. They dovetail, or they're intricately woven with each other very nicely. So it's important to have an understanding of them both. We've been through the book of Revelations. It took us a year and a half to teach through that. I don't think it'll take us a year and a half to teach through Daniel. But it's good to have, you know, who knows, right? But it's good to have an understanding of both of the books. Now, there's another thing that you need to know as we go through the book of Daniel. If you look at the book of Daniel as a whole, as in from chapter 1 through chapter 12, you will notice that it's not told in chronological order, okay? You jump around. The historical narrative comes first, and then the prophetic imagery. So, however, if you were to divide the book up into six chapters, right, into two books, six chapters and six chapters, the first six chapters and the last six chapters, and then you looked at them separately on their own, you would find that the first six chapters historically are in chronological order, and the last six chapters prophetically are in chronological order. So he didn't put it in chronological order as what happened from start part A to part B, but he did put it in chronological order as in what happened historically and then how he received his visions and what he received. If you were to put the book of Daniel chronologically in order, and some people teach it this way, I am not going to teach it this way, it would just confuse the heck out of us. If we were to put it in chronological order, you would read the book of Daniel like this. It would be chapters 1 through 4, and then it would jump to chapter 7, and then it would jump to chapter 8, and then it would go back to chapter 5, and then it would go to chapter 9, and then it would go back to chapter 6, and then it would finish with chapters 10, 11, and 12. That's chronologically how it works. Now, some people flip chapters 9 and 6. Some people think chapter 9 comes after 6. Some people think chapter 9 comes before 6, like I do. It doesn't really matter, but that's more or less the chronological order of the book of Daniel. But as I said, we're just going to go through chapters 1 through 12, and with the understanding that it's not chronological, right? When you get to chapter 7, the vision that he has in chapter 7 happened back, historically speaking, back at a time he's already covered. But he didn't put it in that order. So he wants to go through the history, basically, first, and then through the dreams and visions is how he did it. And you can divide it up into 2 6-chapter segments. And like I said, it can get confusing to some people. So I'm just going to read and teach you the book as it's written. Okay? I'm not going to try to put it in chronological order for you. I don't want it to be too confusing. But as we go through, I'm going to try and keep you appraised of where we are historically, what year it is, who the ruler is. There's four or five different rulers. There's actually more than that. So only the key kings and rulers that he serves under get mentioned in the book of Daniel, but there's actually quite a few other little ones who actually served after Nebuchadnezzar, for example, before Belshazzar, who didn't last very long. So they were there for a year, they were there for a few months, they were there for whatever. Because they didn't have a really long term as king, they don't even get mentioned in the book of Daniel. But so he has all these different kings and rulers that he serves under, and it jumps around. So, but thankfully, Daniel gives us dates and times to help us keep track of what's going on and when it's going on. So we're going to consider this basically an introduction to Daniel. And the reason I picked the first seven verses is because the first seven verses introduces us to not only the time frame in which this is happening, at least how it's starting in chapter 1, but also where it's happening, Babylon, who he's under, Nebuchadnezzar, and who's with him. It's Daniel. There's obviously a lot more people with him than just mentioned, right? Because they take, you know, thousands of people, if not hundreds of thousands of people into captivity. This is the first of the three sieges of Judah. But Daniel is with, of course, three of his friends, right? So let's get started. Let's read Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 through 7. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. Vessels would be like treasures, okay? And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank, and they were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. Let's pray. Lord, I thank you for this word, and I pray, Lord, that you will just speak this to us. I pray, Lord, that your words be spoken, and I pray, Lord, that you will help us gain an incredible knowledge of what is here in this book, and they'll help us apply it to our lives, because this is, we're just dipping our toe in today, and what is here, the picture that is here, the lesson that we can learn from the character and the person of Daniel and how he serves the Lord during this time of captivity is an amazing lesson for us that we can apply to our lives. So I pray, Lord, that you just speak this to us this morning and we'll just draw closer to you. We just thank you, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so chapter 1 says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Like I said, that's the first of three different sieges, okay? So the next one will come in 10 years, and the third siege, I believe, comes 20 years from now. That's when Jerusalem's destroyed. So Jehoiakim became king of Judah somewhere around 605 BC. And this was 607 BC. It's the third year of Jehoiakim's reign. Jehoiakim would actually reign I don't remember how long he reigned, but he reigned something like, I want to say 11 years. I could be wrong. When Nebuchadnezzar, it tells you in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, if you want more about that, you can jump into 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles to get more information about Jehoiakim and also about the siege. But he did not get taken. Jehoiakim did not get taken. So understand that when Nebuchadnezzar comes in to Judah, we'll get into what that is, where that is in just a second. He doesn't take Jehoiakim. He leaves Jehoiakim there as king. And Jehoiakim will later rebel against Nebuchadnezzar, which is why Nebuchadnezzar comes back a second time and why he comes back the third time. Right? So this is his third year as king. There are 20 kings of Judah. Jehoiakim is the 18th of the 20th king. And Jerusalem will be destroyed during the reign of Zedekiah, who is the 20th and the last king of Judah. So the timeline of Daniel starts at 607 BC, as I wrote right here on the screen. It ends at 536 BC, which tells us that Daniel, just so if you want to use those dates for something to try to figure out. I mean, Daniel came in probably in captivity when he was around 15 years old. He was in his 80s, more than likely, at least at the end chapters of Daniel. He hasn't passed yet. He doesn't die in the book of Daniel. He's writing the book of Daniel. So that tells you, though, one thing, because most of us remember Daniel for a couple of reasons. One is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right, in the fire. And the other is Daniel in the lion's den. Those are usually the two reasons that we remember the book of Daniel. Some might remember the writing on the wall. Some might remember the dreams and things like that. But for the most part, it's VeggieTales, right? That's why we remember Daniel. So we think of these two things. Well, a lot of times Daniel's portrayed as this young kid when he's thrown into the lion's den. Daniel was like 70 or 80 years old when he was thrown into the lion's den. I mean, when you follow the timeline and you look at the years, you have to understand that the lion's den was one of the last things that happened before, I believe it's Cyrus. So, I mean, he was under Darius when that happened. So Daniel was, he was like 70, let's say between 70 and 80 years old. He was an old guy. technically speaking, when he's thrown into the lion's den. But other things that are happening globally around this time, if you want to try to put it into a time frame that you understand, construction had started for the Acropolis in Athens. That's happening at this time. Mayan civilization is flourishing in Mexico. That's happening at this time. Aesop is writing his fables. That's happening at this time. Confucius and Buddha were alive, right, at this time. The Greeks were introducing the olive tree to Italy at this time. This is what was happening around the world at the time that Nebuchadnezzar came and besieged Judah and took Daniel into captivity. It took more than Daniel, obviously. And all of that other history pales in comparison to this, though, as far as I'm concerned, right? So I'm not going to go into a huge detail about the history of Israel, but there are things that we should explain so that you know exactly where we are as far as the history of Israel is concerned at the beginning of Daniel, right? So to make a long story even longer, we don't need to know every little piece of what Israel has gone through or what led them to this point in history, but we do need to know some of it. So if you know anything about the history of Israel, you know that as a nation, they're a nation that's had a lot of mountaintops and a lot of valleys, right? You could say that the history of the nation of Israel is a roller coaster ride. It goes up and down and up and down and up and down, right? And the ups are when they're obeying God and the downs are when they're disobeying God. And this it's you can see it when they're in the desert, having just escaped, just been, taken out of bondage from Egypt. Well, that's a mountaintop. Woo, the Lord freed us. We're set free. And then it's immediately a valley when they're rebelling against God in the desert, right? So they just have this, and it's never stopped. It hasn't stopped today, quite frankly. But so their whole existence has been this roller coaster ride up and down. And the reason is very simple, because Israel and the Jews and all of us, quite frankly, are disobedient, sinful people. That's the reason that they have this problem. God wanted to rule his people, his nation, himself. That's what he wanted, right? He wanted Israel was to be a theocracy in that sense. God was to rule them. He is their king. He's their first king. Yes, who's the first king of Israel? People will say it's Saul. No, actually it was God. God is the first king of Israel. That is the way God wanted it. He wanted to be their one and only king. But because the people are sinful and disobedient and rebellious, that is not how it played out, right? So they rejected God. The people ruled themselves, right? In Judges, it gives us a good description. It says, everyone did as he saw fit. And that's pretty much exactly what happened. So that's never a good recipe for anything. That's disobedience. That's sin. That's why the world's so screwed up today. And that's why our nation is two steps from the grave, because everyone did as he saw fit. And no one's listening to or obedient to the word of God, right? Proverbs 14:2 tells us that whoever walks in uprightness fears the Lord, but he who is devious in his ways despises him. And, we live in a nation that despises God. Well, Israel had moments in their history where they despised God, where they rejected God, right? So this is the problem that Israel has found themselves in, with God wanting to rule them and they rejecting God. So God, he at this time, before this time, I should say, he used the judges, of course. He had different ways of wanting to rule. And that, of course, leads us to Samuel, who was a pretty good judge, one of the last good judges. And his sons, of course, Samuel's sons, who were not good at all. As it tells us that they took bribes and they perverted justice. You can read that in 1 Samuel 8. And that whole idea, so the judges didn't help either. So the people, basically the elders, came together and said, hey, listen, we want a king. And when we say we want a king, we mean an earthly king, right? We want someone to rule over us like all the other nations have. We want to be like everybody else. Give us a king. So Samuel's like, well, I got to go talk to God about this, right? And God says, give them what they want. It's not you they're rejecting, Samuel. They're rejecting me. And again, you can read about this in 1 Samuel 8. And again, this is a bad place to find yourself in. It's a bad place to find yourself in when you are in a situation where you're rejecting God's rule over your life, which is what Israel had done. Israel said, no, we want an earthly king. Let's be like everyone else. God says, no, I made you to be set apart from everyone else. But God tells Samuel, okay, give them what they want. If that's what they want, give them what they want. Romans 1 talks about this in the end times, in the end days, right? The world's going to have gotten so evil, God's just going to give them what they want. Okay, you want all that immorality? Here it is. Have it. It's to your detriment. And it was to Israel's detriment. So God grants their request. And of course, the first earthly king they had was Saul, and then David, and then Solomon. But after the death of Solomon, things changed. And Israel found itself at war with each other, in a sense. They didn't agree on things, right? We might say this is sort of a geopolitical thing, right? There was tribal discord and political unrest between the different tribes. So that Israel becomes divided. It becomes divided into a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. And the northern kingdom has 10 tribes, which was often called, the northern kingdom was often called Israel. Sometimes they called it Ephraim. And then the southern kingdom was Judah and Benjamin, only 2 tribes, and it was called Judah. And that's the kingdom that we're dealing with here in Daniel, Judah. Judah is the kingdom which Nebuchadnezzar is laying siege to here in verse 1. So just a really bonus question really quick. So since Israel was divided, was Israel then reunited or united as a kingdom at the time of Christ? I mean, this is 600 years before the time of Christ, right? When we're in Daniel, I think it's roughly 600 years. Right? So we know that they were a nation divided. Technically, they weren't really divided because the northern kingdom was gone at this point. But the southern kingdoms being put into bondage, were they united as a kingdom then at the time of Christ? And the answer is no, they weren't. They weren't. They had more land. It wasn't divided up into 2 kingdoms in that sense. But they will be united again. And it's talked about in Isaiah. This is the millennial reign. It says in Isaiah chapter 11, it says, he will raise a signal for the nations and will assemble the banished of Israel and gather the dispersed of Judah from the 4 corners of the earth. The jealousy of Ephraim shall depart, and those who harass Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not be jealous of Judah, and Judah shall not harass Ephraim. So in other words, all the quarreling is going to end, and they will come together again. It's going to happen. So Israel is divided, and we can look at all the different political reasons or all the different, you know, worldly reasons that divided them, but the real reason that they were divided was sin. It's sin that brings division. So that's what divided Israel. And Samuel warned them. He said, listen, if you want a king, this is how kings are going to behave. This is how kings are going to operate. He gives them a whole list. Again, you can read it in 1 Samuel 8 there. And so, if it's what you want, we'll give it to you, right? So the kings that ruled over both Israel and Judah at that point, the northern and the southern kingdom during this time of division, for the most part, these kings were exactly as they were warned they would be, right? Because yes, I mean, Saul wasn't a great king, but he wasn't a terrible, terrible king. David, you know, a man after God's own heart, everyone looks at as a great king. This was before the division, of course, but David was a terrible person as well. Look what he did. I'm not going to go over the whole story. And of course, Solomon, who had all the wisdom in the world as far as the king and all the wealth and the riches, and this is the temple. The temple of Solomon is the one that's going to be destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. But he wasn't a great person either, right? He helped worship false idols too. So when it goes into the divided kingdoms, then it just continues like this. So during this time of division, for the most part, the kings are exactly as they were warned they would be. They led the people astray. They were disobedient to the word of God. They worshiped false idols, etc. I mean, the kings of Israel or Ephraim, they practiced idolatry. They served Baal. Some of those kingdoms served Baal over there. Many of the kings of Judah served idols as well. Few of the kings served the Lord faithfully. Few of them. I mean, some bad kings were partly good and some good kings were partly bad, but overall they were not faithful or obedient to God. Matter of fact, Jehoiakim, who was the king at the time here in verse 1 of Daniel, 2 Kings chapter 23 tells us this. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years. So there we go, I was right, 11 years. He reigned 11 years in Jerusalem, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord according to all his fathers was done. So he wasn't even a good king. He was an evil king. So God judges them because sin brings division, but it also brings judgment. So God's judgment against sin was to put Israel into bondage. So he puts the kingdoms into bondage, and he started with the northern kingdom some 115 years before what we're reading here in Daniel. The Assyrians come down and were besieged the northern kingdom, and they take him off into captivity, and they destroy everything, and the northern kingdom is gone. It doesn't even exist at this time of Daniel. There's a few people left here and there, but for the most part, the northern kingdom is gone. And now it's the southern kingdom being besieged by Nebuchadnezzar. And like I said, it's the first of three sieges. The third siege, the siege in which they destroy the temple, they killed 500,000 women, men, women, and children during that third siege in Jerusalem when Nebuchadnezzar comes down. So this was judgment from God against his chosen people for not keeping God's commandments. Specifically, the commands prohibiting idolatry, but not limited to idolatry. Matter of fact, one of the things that God is judging me for is this. It's called the sabbatical year. It has to do with rest, but it has to do with rest for the land. God told them how to take care of their land. Actually, farms who follow this pattern today still benefit from it. You are to work the land for 6 years, and on the seventh year, give it a rest. And God told them, he said, if you do this, if you have faith to follow me in this, if you obey my word in this, on that sixth year, before you take that seventh year off, on that sixth year, I'm going to give you like triple the bounty. So that next year that you have off, that you're resting and you're not working, you're going to have enough grain to get through it. You're going to have food. You're not going to be hungry. And then for the year after that, where you start planting again, but it hasn't grown up yet, and you're waiting for the harvest to come in, you're still going to have enough food to get through until the harvest comes in. So I'm going to take care of you. But what did Israel do? Israel looked at that and said, oh, I see a chance to make a lot of money, right? So they would get that triple bounty in the sixth year. They would sell all the extra grain because they knew they were in the seventh year that they were supposed to be resting. They would actually work it instead. So they became wealthy, but they were disobeying God. Right? But in observing that sabbatical year was a very important sign of trusting in God. And if you did it, you were accompanied by great blessings. However, the flip side of that coin was that if you refused to obey God in that, it would lead to a curse. And this is in Leviticus, among other places. In Leviticus 26, this is what God says if you don't listen to him and obey his word. He says, I will scatter you among the nations. I will unsheathe the sword after you, and your land shall be a desolation, and your city shall be a waste. Then the land shall enjoy its Sabbaths. As long as it lies desolate, well, you are in your enemy's land, and then the land shall rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. As long as it lies desolate, it shall have rest, the rest that it did not have on your Sabbaths when you were dwelling in it. So God says, if you don't listen to me on this, and you continue to be disobedient to me, if you continue to live a sinful life going against my word, it's not just for this specifically, but for all these different things, he says, I'm going to bring judgment on you. I'm going to make sure that land gets its rest like I wanted it to have, that you're not giving it. But they just continued to work the land on that seventh year, and they did it for a long, long, long time. And you might say, how long did they do it? They worked that land on that seventh year for 490 years. So now if you do the math and you try to figure out they were supposed to have a year of rest every 7 years, and you figure that out for 490 years, how many years of that does that land need to rest? 70 years. How long are they going to be in captivity? Yeah, 70 years. God planned it. Jeremiah also prophesied about it. They're going to be 70 years. Jeremiah knew what God had already said about judgment concerning this if you continue to be disobedient. That is what Daniel reads later on when we go through Daniel, when he reads the book of Jeremiah and realizes they're supposed to be only in captivity for 70 years, and it's coming up. It's almost been 70 years. Right? So all that to say that when we read verse 1 here, we are during a time in history when the kingdom had been divided and the southern kingdom was all that was left, and now they are being besieged as a result of their sins, plural, not just one sin, many sins, right? God first brought the Assyrians in, now he brings the Babylonians in, and God's people are being removed from the promised land, and Jerusalem will be destroyed soon, in around 20 years from now. And when Nebuchadnezzar came in, he looted some of the temple and took some of the temple goods. Again, you can read more about that in 2 Kings 24. And he brought him back and he put him in the treasury of his god, a god with a little g. But he didn't just bring back treasures and wealth. He brought back people. And obviously we're only told about four of those people, but he brought back people. Now, I want you to pay attention to this next section, because Nebuchadnezzar commands that they bring back youth, which just means boy or young man. Right? Daniel was probably a teenager. We think he was 15 or around 15. He could have been a little younger, but he was probably a teenager. Right? But look at how he describes them. This is how the youth should be. So first, they need to be of the royal family and of nobility. Okay? Two different things, both of the royal family and of nobility, so they go one or the other. Youth without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace. Right? So that means, first of all, Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, isn't it interesting that we always refer to Daniel by his Hebrew name, but Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego we refer to by their Babylonian names? And if I hadn't read their Hebrew names here, you probably wouldn't know what their Hebrew names were, would you? Because we never refer to them by their Hebrew names. But what it tells you is that Daniel is of either the royal line or of nobility, as is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Okay? Which maybe you never thought of before. I don't know if you had or not. But Daniel could be, possibly even, if not a direct descendant of David, a cousin or so of a direct descendant of David. All the kings of Judah were direct descendants of David, every single one of them. So if Daniel is of the royal line, he's a direct descendant of David, or if he's of nobility, he's related to the royal line, which means he's a cousin or something of a direct descendant of David. Right? And it's also possible that when they brought them in captivity, these young men that they want to train up in the ways of the Babylonian royals, right? Just like how Joseph, became an Egyptian when he was in Egypt, they now have to become Babylonians. And he wants to teach them the language of the Chaldeans, and he wants to have them read the Babylonian literature, and he wants to train them up. This is all about assimilation into the Babylonian culture, but it's also possible that they were made eunuchs. Okay? And the reason I say that is that it was prophesied. Okay? It's Isaiah 39, verses 6 and 7. And Isaiah 39, verses 6 and 7 says, "Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and that which your fathers have stored up till this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. And some of your own sons who will come from you, whom you will father, shall be taken away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." It was prophesied. So more than likely, Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego all became eunuchs. All of this plays into the character of Daniel and Daniel's response to what's going on as things go throughout the time that he has this time of ministry in Babylon. You might start thinking about how you would feel if, one, they take you from your homeland, two, they kill your family more than likely, they drag you hundreds and hundreds of miles away to a foreign land, they want you to assimilate to their ways, they make you a eunuch, and they want to train you up, what your response to them might be. When you think about, as we'll see as we continue through Daniel's response. So Daniel and his friends would have been assimilated into Babylonian culture. It's possible that someone who may have known Daniel could see Daniel 10 years later and not even know it was Daniel. Depending on how he looked and how he was dressed. Because remember, Daniel served in pretty much a very high place of authority. So the youth, obviously, that they brought, as we know, that's introduced to us here at the end of the chapter, is Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And of course, we know them as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They changed their names from their Hebrew names to Babylonian names. Their names went from honoring God, because if you look up what their names mean in Hebrew, to either honoring the king Nebuchadnezzar or honoring a false god in the Babylonian Empire. Their lives went from serving God to having to serve now a pagan king and a false god. But as it turns out, Daniel had purpose in his heart to not defile himself in that way. And we'll go into more on that next week. So this is how we're going to wrap up our intro. I want you to take this home with you. As we go through this book, specifically within the first six chapters, before we change gears into Daniel's dreams and all the prophecies, you're going to see a common thread, these first six chapters of Daniel. And this is the common thread. I'll give it to you in a verse from 1 Corinthians. It's 1 Corinthians 7:23. It says, "You were bought with a price. Do not become bondservants of men." Despite all that Daniel and his friends were going through and that they would go through, well, slaves to Nebuchadnezzar, technically, they would choose to serve God first and not become bondservants of men. Right? They were slaves, yes, but they were slaves to God first. They understood, or they would come to understand, who God was and how God worked. Right? They had faith in a God bigger than the king of Babylon, and whichever king they may be serving, because like I said, they served under quite a few kings, more than four or five. I think it was six or seven kings, or maybe even more, that they served under. Right? And but during that time, their lives became a testimony to the true and living God. Right? Their faith became an example to all the other captives who might have been struggling with what had just happened to them, having been taken into captivity. Daniel shows that he understands the sovereignty of God and that God governs in the affairs of men. Daniel shows that he understands that God raises up kings and rulers and uses them for his purpose, including to judge the earth or to judge Judah, as it were, or to even judge Nebuchadnezzar, as he will later. It's all because of the authority of God. But Daniel also understood this, that he serves God, he doesn't serve man. Right? And you have to think about that from a unique viewpoint, because remember, Daniel was taken from his home, and like I said, his family was killed, probably, more than likely. It doesn't necessarily say specifically, but you know, it's not like Nebuchadnezzar just walked down into Jerusalem and said, "Hey, anybody want to come to Babylon with me?" And everybody jumped on the little thing and went off to a foreign country. No, it was sieged, right? So there was war, and there was destruction, and there was death. None of that is really described to us in Daniel. But when they rip you out of your life like that and they bring you somewhere else, you could hold a lot of bitterness and resentment to God. You could be like, "God, why did you allow this to happen? Right? Why did you take me from my country? Why did you take me from my family?" But Daniel didn't seem to hold any of that resentment. Daniel didn't seem to have any problems with that, because Daniel understood that it didn't matter where he was, what nation he was in, or even what king he was under. Because it didn't change a thing about God. And it was God who he served. So if he can serve God under an evil king like Jehoiakim in Judah, he can still serve God while being a slave in bondage under a pagan king like Nebuchadnezzar. It doesn't change anything. So that's what Daniel understood. He serves God, not man. Daniel's allegiance is to God and God alone. He served God under an evil king. He will serve God under a pagan king, right? Even though his nation will soon be destroyed, even though the temple will soon be destroyed, even though his life will be threatened, he will serve God first. And because of this, Daniel will be protected. Right? He will be a blessing and a testimony to those he serves. All the kings that he served under, for the most part, loved Daniel. They benefited from having Daniel in their service. Right? Daniel's going to have a long and fruitful ministry. some 80 years, easily. Because Daniel would not be conformed. Right? He would not be conformed to the ways of this worldly kingdom. Because he'd been transformed by the power of God. Amen?